It's cool to finally talk to you, man. I've been reading the blog for since, like, I don't know, 2009 or 10. The various blogs, I should say.
Oh, that's quite some time.
Yeah.
Is this the first time that you've commented or reached out?
No, I used to mess around, like, 2010-ish. It was when I first, you know, the alternative research area of the internet addiction here. So 2010, I got into the Synchromystic thing, and I forgot how I ended up at Red Ice. It was, you know, a link took me there, and I was like, oh, look at this. They talk to people. And the first three, I think, were Freeman Fly, you, and 9/11 something or other, and maybe the young guy Rick Clay there that ended up committing suicide, actually. And I was like, well, Jason seems legit, and these other people are sort of strange. So I sort of followed you, you know, here and there.
You wouldn't have known I was Jason back then, right?
Oh, yeah,
unless
okay.
It was an old show, yeah.
No, you were Aeolus Cephas, I believe. It was the Lucid View podcast.
Right. Yeah, Alternate Perceptions Community.
Yes.
But it was way after Lucid View, because I had a real hard time getting on Red Eyes.
Yeah, I could probably see that, and I remember liking that one the most, because I thought you were kind of funny about the whole interview. Like, Freeman kind of kissed his ass, and I don't know, Rick was all over the place, and the 9/11 thing was what it was. But you were like, kind of, oh, it's nice to meet you, but what exactly are we doing here? And this was before I knew what the Lucid View book was all about, kind of. So I kind of thought it was funny that someone was coming on the Red Eyes show and asking
yeah.
what's going on.
Yeah, well, I'm glad for that now, because, of course, with the way that Red Eyes has gone lately, I'm somewhat ambivalent about being up there at all, being associated with them at all, so at least I did.
Yeah, I can yeah. see that, what you mean. Like, you kind of went in there when it was, you know, it wasn't too extreme, and now they only do shows that they're pushing for their little whatever's happening in Europe. I mean, I'm over in New Hampshire, so I can't say too much. It's funny, I work for a guy, he's an old man now, his name is Fritz. He's from the mountains between Switzerland and France, but he's a worldly guy. He owns a hotel over here in New Hampshire. He's always saying, oh, you know, how scary it is what's happening in Europe. And he's sort of a quiet guy, and I can never tell if he's scared of the nationalism or the crime elevation with all these people coming in.
Right. Yeah, we have a neighbor here who has been talking about it, about all the women being raped in Europe by these immigrants, supposedly, allegedly. And, it became a fixation for him, and it seemed as though he'd ended up following links on the internet and going to different sites and where that aspect is being emphasized, is being really emphasized, right? And so, and that just became this, for him, that was like the whole thing, you know. You just end up at one site that's presenting it in a certain way with a certain spin and a certain angle, and then that's it, you know, you kind of...
Yeah, and not to jump into Whitley too soon, but I think it may be like, they know what sells, and the, I believe the term is, conspindustry, I've heard it said, I can't say who coined that, but they know what sells, and it matches some sort of wound, and it's just hot right now, I suppose.
Right, well, it's very primal. I mean, that particular one, the idea of barbarians coming in and raping your women, I mean, what could be more primal than that?
Yes, the myth of the rape of Europa right now, this is very hot again.
I don't. I mean, I think it's Canada, so I don't.
Yeah.
I was following it a little bit when they're building a wall in Austria, and I have a friend or an ally there who has just volunteered and been doing volunteer work in Greece with immigrants, and so I'm somewhat aware of the situation,
but
very, very periphery. And,
yeah, it's like these conspiracy people, when they find this info, this new hot button, you know, the rape of Europe issue, like, they totally forget the things that they've maybe were supposed to be learning on this journey, like question the media, question what you're seeing, like, I don't know, it seems like when these hot button things come up, they jettison everything they may have learned.
Yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, yeah, Red Ice is how I found you, and I've drifted in and out of the various projects. I really liked the, I think it was Warty Theorems there, the podcast and the blog for a while.
Yeah, Warty Theorems was just, I think that was just a podcast after stormy weather, post-stormy weather. Sweater, that was in the thick of Sweater.
Yeah, the Sweater. Yeah, I listened to a little of the Stormy Weather. I may have, you know, seen you on Red Ice and been late coming back. I checked out, you know, I think the Neil Kramer one. I may have mentioned this to you in a previous email while I was in Russia. So I've been here and there. I really liked the thing. I don't know if it ever took off. With Joe the Indian there, you were doing the Beyond Dirt kind of videos for a while.
Right.
I thought that was, you know, it was cool. It was nice video editing and had a good vibe to it.
You sound quite young. How old are you?
I'm 32 years young. I'll be 33 in April.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty young.
Oh, thank you. You mind if I ask how old you are?
48.
Oh, all right. Yeah, yeah, cool. Well, yeah, so, I mean, some of my favorites, I don't know if you're interested, but maybe you are. Like, I just saw, actually, a random side note. I had been away from the blog for a few days, and you've posted a lot on the blog and the podcast, a lot of updates. And I maybe glanced at a comment where you were, like, saying that you really like the echo chamber and the feedback. It kind of grounds or something what you're up to at the moment.
Yeah, I remember that comment. There's been some very strong confirmation, like people have been commenting who seem to have been doing, I don't know if it's necessarily research or just experience and deduction. I guess everything's research if you're applying it and to deepen your understanding. And so, yeah, people who are coming to similar conclusions, that's not premature, but, you know, tentative interpretations of what's going on, that seem to be really confirming the picture that I'm trying to put together now, which is, I guess, an alternative to conspiracy theory, in part. I mean, social engineering isn't by any means a new term or radical or anything like that, but it's very, very different, I think you may agree, from the standard conspiracy theory narrative that is out there, even though there's the same elements, the usual suspects, the same groups, the same agendas, and yet somehow the emphasis is just that subtly different, but it's profoundly different. I just posted something, a comment, with this article by Lloyd DeMouse on satanic, quote-unquote, ritual abuse, which he wrote 20 years ago. I just found it, and he talks about how the ritual abuse of cults that is incredibly prevalent, and that the same methods and practices and behaviors recur throughout all these countless cases across the world. But he begins by saying in this part that it doesn't mean it's a worldwide conspiracy, and as an alternative he outlines the psychological makeup, really, the way that the psyche reacts to trauma and the way that it compensates and the way that it tries to deal with the trauma and by not dealing with it, and that this accounts for very specific kinds of behavior. Okay, so that's just one example, but
yeah,
and it's not either or either, because people who are similarly traumatized get together and they do create cults, and cults lead to, you know, movements and all the rest of it. So, but still, underneath the external mechanics of conspiracy culture, the culture of conspiracy, that there is psychology, and that is so much more subtle and so much more widespread. And of course, it includes all of us. So that would be, I guess, the primary subtle difference between what I'm trying to map and what conspiracy theorists are trying to map, which is that there simply isn't an us and them division in social engineering as I see it, because we've been engineered to become social engineers. We collaborate, we become complicit with the culture that created us.
Yeah, yeah, I see. This is why I think I like the Strieber stuff here, although the Crucial Fictions podcast were too intense for me because you had so many samples of Strieber's voice. Anyway, the conspiracy thing as sort of an outgrowth of a deeper psychological thing happening, I think this is sort of fruitful soil.
Mm-hmm. So you find Strieber's voice too grating to listen to?
I knew this would come up, and I can't even put into words how it rubs me the wrong way on the inside. Not to make sex puns already with this, but it feels awful. I mean, granted, he's talking about some pretty heavy things. I think some of the ones that bothered me the most were the hypnosis sessions. Did you put those in there?
It's funny because I've just put one up at the blog because people are questioning that, you know, nothing, saying maybe nothing happened to Strieber, and I'm saying, well, just listen to the hypnosis thing if you think nothing happened to the guy. But anyway, there were samples included in the Crucial Fictions MP3s because, of course, I did all those mashups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that was what it, I mean, I liked the art. I liked kind of where you were going because at the time I was reading the Carl Jung UFO book. I was like, oh, cool, Jason's doing this far-out thing. You look at these kids in this glowing light, and, oh, man, Strieber's voice turned me right off.
And you hadn't heard it before then?
Well, no, I had not heard. You know, I had only known Whitley Strieber from this Communion book that you can find in every used bookstore in the United States and maybe even the world.
No kidding, yeah, or Transformation, or one of them anyway.
Yeah.
So you'd read Communion, and that was it?
I had read Communion, and I'd seen the other ones at the same bookstore, and she was like, oh, I have more Strieber, and I said, no, thank you.
But this was before you'd heard him?
Yes, this is before I'd even heard his voice. I had read Communion.
So then even reading Communion didn't make you curious?
Well, I don't know. I think I was, like I said, at this time I was sort of doing the Jungian, the reading of that, you know, UFOs over Soul, whatever the heck it's called, and you know, I just saw all of Strieber's book through that lens at the time. It may have, you know, distorted any truth behind it, but I saw it as, like, someone that some bad shit happened to, and, you know, he's got some weird stories, and I didn't say, oh, I bet you there's greys, and I bet you they're, you know, coming down and poking around in our butts, and et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So I maybe dismissed him from the beginning as far as the aliens go, but as far as someone who had some bad things happen to him, I mean, didn't resonate with me, so I didn't look any further into it.
Right, until Crucial Fiction.
Well, yeah, you know, like I said, you see him as a pretty straight-up guy in the strange world of alternative research, or whatever you want to call what's happening here. So, you know, I was like, oh, cool, I'll check out what Jason's up to. Like, you always do something that what am I trying to say here? Like, you got, like, kind of like Talking Heads, and I'm into that, and you play guitar and do silly songs, I'm into that. So, like, a lot of things resonate, so I don't mind. Whatever you're up to writing, I'll always check it out.
Mm-hmm. Don't really do silly songs anymore. It seems to have fallen by the wayside.
Those were fun, though.
So, do you know that Strieber's voice was my first tip-off? I mean, when I first really began to suspect that there was something not right about Strieber was after I heard his voice.
I wasn't aware, no, but I can see that for sure.
Hmm. But on the other hand, it's kind of different from yourself. I actually have found, and to some extent continue to find, listening to him kind of pleasant, even though I won't say objectively, obviously it's not objective, but even though I see it's to me, it's quite an unpleasant way of speaking, and it's inauthentic, and it's brash, and there's nothing really that I can see why I like about it. But somehow I've often found listening to his voice really relaxing. It's very strange, and one of the things I deduce from it, or guess, is that it relates to him being traumatized, and somehow that resonates with my own trauma in some way.
Yeah, I think resonates is the perfect word there. I would kind of, in my head, I'd see it as, you know, you and Strieber have sort of some crossover here, so, like, listening to his voice sort of maybe loosens up, you know, so to say, some things inside of you, and then you can sort of shift that around, and that's sort of a pleasurable feeling. Like, some people like Terrence McKenna's voice, some people don't, they find him annoying. Yeah.
Don't know how anyone could like that.
Yeah, again, we can get into the Esalen stuff later. Good God. But yeah, I could see, since you have so much of this crossover with Whitley, despite the age gap, which is, anyway, that voice for you would do something different than it did for me, who sort of had apple pie and baseball American childhood in the 80s, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just glanced at your Occult Yorkshire stuff here, which looks pretty intense. I can see a little bit of the... let's see if I can even express this here. Like, Why? Again, because of this similarity in your pasts, like how this is helping you look at you, and then sort of extrapolating it to the greater wound in Western man's psyche. I don't know if you take this global all over the place, but it just all sorts to click for me anyway.
Anything else about that?
Well, I mean, that I guess that I had more of a question for you. Like, do you see, like, I'm picturing that you're sort of implying that this wound that Whitley has is, it's on a bigger scale, it's happening. Now, do you mean to the Western man, or to, you know, modern man?
Well, both. I mean, I think that the, you know, the mechanism of the psyche as far as trauma and dissociation is universal, but the ways in which the the culture shapes the constructed identity, so the way in which we interpret our dissociative visions, let's say, the kind of crucial fictions we create would be very culture-based, just as Strieber himself has acknowledged. His interpretation of whatever it is that is happening to him has been influenced by 50 sci-fi and whatnot. Like, he'll go far enough to acknowledge that. So that's a superficial layer of this, that in terms of the way in which we turn our dissociative fantasy pH, you know, the worlds that we dissociate into to escape from trauma, we turn those into narratives that we can actually use as currency, you know, incorporate into our identities. That would be very cultural.
Yeah.
But the actual...
Yeah, like, so someone that didn't go through the modern Western birth of the doctor and the bright lights and the isolation wouldn't necessarily have the same experiences after trauma that someone that had been born in the Western world would have, maybe.
Yeah, although, because we can get into specifics, then we get into questions of how much is physically happening to Whitley, because it may be that whoever, military intelligence, are actually enacting scenarios at a physical level and so on and so forth. But even there, they would have been if they were theatre, they'd have been created current with that person's interpretation system and so on. And yeah, I mean, I haven't looked much into Eastern stuff at all, but they certainly have myths and presumably direct personal experiences of gods and whatnot interacting with human beings in ways just like fairy lore that would overlap in many ways with all of this modernized scientistic
version. Yeah.
So it would be interesting, but to me that you can like Lavender's written countless books about Eastern religion. Kripal supposedly a scholar of religion, but these guys, as far as I can see it, they're actually avoiding the real core truth of it. And I think partly that can happen. Like, if you just get too much into sifting through the data and comparing, you can just never find the ground, never mind lose it, you never even find it. And just absolutely miss the gorilla in the room, you know, miss the forest for the trees. So for me, it's that's all just, and a lot of people don't get this one, all about Strieber, and he's just a useful case study. That's all it is. So what counts are the insights that looking at that material allow for.
The useful reflections you can sort of see by looking at it.
The correspondence is in my own direct experience that then allows for an integration of unconscious matter, and something is happening. I mean, but what is happening is quite ephemeral, even though paradoxically it's becoming embodied, so it's grounding, it's absolutely real. But I would say, I mean, here's an example maybe of, like, I've just taken over the thrift store, the second-hand business, as I mentioned in a recent podcast, and it's turned my life around in a subtle but dramatic way. Suddenly I'm interacting with the community, interacting with just, you know, ordinary quote-unquote people, and it's very grounding for me in terms of all the stuff I do, writing and podcasting. It's really so out there, and it can really be quite the opposite of grounding. And so to have this balancing things out. But I would say that actually, in a certain sense, that the opportunity and the development of being more integrated into my community and having this business and starting to earn money, these are actually concrete results of the work and the fight I've been doing with Streba, right? So it's not about writing a book or coming up with this fantastic new model or revolutionizing the world of ufology. It just turns out that it's really about how can I live more in the world by recognizing the ways that I'm not of the world, you know, by individuating from the world, I'm entering more and more into the world.
Yeah, that, you know, that's kind of perfect. Like, it's sort of an accidental byproduct of you grounding yourself. Like you say, you're not trying to write a book, but this stuff is just squirting out as you, you know, become more involved, meet people. And that's funny that you, I didn't hear this, it must have been in one I haven't caught yet, that you had had this business, and you say that meeting people is, like, one of the cool parts of it. I mean, I guess secondhand stuff and your house restoration may go together, too, but anyway... I'm a waiter sometimes, and you know, amongst other things, and people are like, you have so many cool jobs, like why do you wait tables at this hotel? And it's like something very grounding and real about meeting strangers in a comfortable, happy situation, sort of random.
That's right.
It's very human.
Well, it's good that you've got the comfortable, happy situation. I don't use the word happy, but I was just talking to my sister about the thrift store and how it's this very warm environment, because I really enjoy, so far, doing it. I enjoy getting these donations and sifting through them and then selling them, and we're providing this service, really, of redistribution of not wealth, but of property. It is wealth, I guess, but, you know, in a very low-scale way. And so because I'm in that place in myself and doing it with my wife, so we've created a space that reflects that, and then people enter into it, so then the interactions are warm. But of course somebody else could be working. I mean, most jobs, even though there's human interaction, they don't really allow for the warmth, because they're not integral or organic to that person's own individuation process. Most people are doing jobs just because they need the money, and for me, I'm almost 50, and this is the first time really that I've finally established a kind of a form of income in the world, and it has come about as a side effect. And it wasn't because I was doing the law of attraction either, you know, like how am I going to manifest my destiny? And it wouldn't be accurate to say what you just said before, that I wasn't trying to write a book. I am trying to write a book. I am a writer who writes books. I just mean that's sort of a trick, really, because the meaning or the satisfaction that I get from writing a book, even if it were to get reviewed well and sell and all that, is so relatively superficial as compared to what happens through the process of writing it, the integration, and then see the side effect. It seems what I'm exploring with you now is, it seems like the side effect of Prisoner Infinity, not only, but seeing as that's on the table, wasn't that I got to publish the book, you know, real world consequences that in that way, but that I got a secondhand bookstore, which has nothing to do with, you know, really, it's just that's embodiment.
Yeah, and, like, you know, I think the more you can get your head out of the infosphere a little bit and more onto the ground with the people, the more rewarding it can be than losing yourself on, you know,
yeah,
on the internet.
Yeah, well, that's true. Because I only work one full day a week at the moment, and nice. Saturday, and I was, last time I worked there wasn't much traffic, and we don't have internet yet, and so I was chomping at the bit for the internet, and I was saying to my wife, I've got to get internet, because otherwise I feel like a prisoner there, sorry, Whitley-esque, you know, just sitting there waiting for custom,
yeah,
right?
For some interesting person to come in and be like, I have this obsession, do you have records
even, but just to feel like I was... it was fruitful, you know, like my time was being justified. But yesterday it was so active that even if I'd had the internet, I wouldn't have spent any time on it. And so that's quite a sort of microcosmic, really, because you're right, it's absolutely, it's actually a tonic for the disembodiment of the internet activities, which is also ego inflatory for me if it's going well, as it has been recently, and getting lots of validation. And I tweeted recently this, that it's not a question of whether the ego inflation results from success, but of how much and how much you notice it. Because really, I'm starting to notice it now. It just a little bit of validation and the inflation begins. And it's just not obvious. You don't have to become a cult leader, you know, or just start ranting about how great you are. It's very, very subtle, just being validated by the world. We're so hungry for that, or I am.
Yeah, no, I think that runs through, I think, everybody. I mean, not to jump off on a tangent real quick, but they hired me to DJ an ice bar here at the hotel. They didn't want to pay a real DJ to stand out in the cold, so I slapped together a playlist, and I felt like I wanted people to like the songs that I picked, even though I didn't express it to anyone. So, like, that little need, like you say, for a little validation, I think that's everywhere.
Yeah, of course, it is everywhere. I mean, yeah. It's a lot of what I write about. It's,
yeah, yeah.
That's part of the wound, yeah. But again, it's like if you take the world's validation, the world is a very vague concept because it's really just coming from individuals. But if we take external validation in the wrong way or in a certain way, then we just need more and more. Whereas, as opposed to taking it in such a way that we need less and less, right? So that's the thing, is either are we becoming more, less of the world and more in the world, or are we becoming more of the world and less in the world? Those would be that's the sort of spectrum of embodiment, disembodiment, because the less embodied we are, the more we need the external validation to feel real.
Yeah,
because we don't actually have the sensory experience of being.
Yeah, here. Yeah. It's more like a brain happy versus a body happy.
Yeah, exactly. Which is back to Whitley with his greys. Like, what are these beings now? These spindly, shriveled bodies with the huge brains. So it's
and huge black eyes. Yeah, yeah. I think that's why I picked the book up in the first place, was that goddamn picture. You know, I didn't know who Whitley Strieber was. You know, I was like, oh, look at this thing. Mm-hmm. So there's maybe something instinctually, something about that image. I guess I watched a lot of movies as a kid too. So like you say, the distorted perception that have been installed are sort of already hijacked, kind of.
It's time now to practice some very useful phrases. I'll say them first, you repeat, and we'll learn together. Let's begin.
When I was a little boy, used to walk along the dotted line. Oh, with a lack of direction, the Makita projection always made them seem so large at the time. But you see, now that I'm a little bit older, I can realize the path that I love. So to finally strike my reality, I built this town inside my head.
For the sake of my genius, so
woods upside of the road. So I built my empire off the glitch in the atlas with a map you didn't have to go. And over the years the populace became attracted, the imaginary city would grow. Forgetting their loneliness, troubles and fears, only one road leads to Aglo. So we go.
As opções turísticas é que há.
Oh.
manuscrito, meu circunscrito, vira viva ele insisto.
The best poem was by my mother.
Vá até ao centro histórico da cidade.
Now you try.
Força da imaginação. Vai lá, além dos pés e do chão. Chega lá, porque a mão ainda não trocou. Coração nos alcança. Força da imaginação. Vai lá, força da imaginação.
Yeah, well, the, you know, just to bring it down to possibly a trivial detail, but the, I guess it's not trivial, really, because it's so central, as you say, the cover of Communion, because that also affected me. I certainly didn't buy it because of the cover. I heard about Streber in the book, and then when I was in Mexico, and then when I went to the US, I hunted. The first thing I did was find that book and buy it and read it. But the cover, it really did. I used that image all the time, and the image really meant a lot to me, and I identified with it. Like I would say, do I look like that? Don't I look like that? Isn't that me? kind of thing. And the thing is the image on the cover isn't grey. So when Streber started talking about the greys years later, I looked and looked to find somewhere where he acknowledged this. Why is he calling them greys when he's presented this image to the world that is absolutely not grey? It never has been. He's never explained that, really. It's not all bad. There is something about that image and about the archetypal resonance of something that I still think is in Communion. I don't think it's all. It's like any kind of poison delivery device. If we're going to look at it that way, and even that's quite heavily negative. It has to have a. And it's not just about sugar coating. I mean, because that you can get that by the masses, but you can't get it by the more discerning. And I think what social engineering. It goes deeper than just social. It seems to me that it is about deceiving the elect, to use a, you know, maybe a socially engineered phrase or what have you, but part of the mythology in the Bible is that the elect will be deceived, whatever that means. It means, to deceive the psyche itself.
Not social engineering, but like psyche engineering.
So Communion is, it really has to, I think, it has to have a kernel of the absolute truth in it, the experience of the soul that is then kind of wrapped up in or boxed up in this machinery of cultural technology, whereby now Kripal is talking about the soul as this physical thing, and they're talking about, it's as if the attempt to somehow validate mystical spiritual visions in a scientific way entails actually reducing it all to material, to a material dimension by which it can be controlled. And I think that may be the kernel, the crux of, that's certainly what MKUltra is about, how to turn the psyche into a weapon. But bringing back to the personal, like I read Communion and I read it a few times, I don't know how many times, before I began to have my own experiences, but I did begin to have my own experiences, and but I've never had an experience of actually seeing an entity in my room. The closest I got was like glowing figures at the end of my bed many years later. It was around the same time I just described this incident on the last podcast where there was this entity that I had to banish. But anyway, around 2000 I did see some glowing entities at the end of my bed. But mostly the experiences I had that corresponded with Streber's accounts, more or less, were very psychic in nature, as in I was aware, I was awake, or I would wake up, and I was aware of a presence in the room, and I was absolutely totally aware, like its psyche was inside mine, or mine was inside, you know, it was a non-physical awareness. I was aware of its attention and its presence, and I was far too frightened to open my eyes and look. It didn't even occur to me, but nor did I really think there was a physical or an organic presence there. It seemed to be so much more than just a physical presence. And you know, I interpreted it like Streber did at the time, that this was either like a guardian, not in the cowshed sense, of course, and it's a funny, ironic overlap now, but like a holy guardian angel type thing, and or my own soul, you know, the presence of my own psyche, and or like a fairy being, like a really ancient, powerful fairy being, like Streber. So all these overlaps with his experiences. And what do I think of that now? I mean, I don't think of it as it wasn't informed by sci-fi stuff or by grace. I didn't think of it as an alien visitation. I do think, it was more than that. There was some really like an element of my psyche. But on the other hand, it was still this very powerful, somewhat sexual presence in my room in the night, terrifying. So still, now I would say, okay, maybe something traumatic happened to me, and then the psyche split, and then I experienced, the larger part of my psyche is this protective guardian angel, while the smaller part, and so on and so forth. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You did. The second chapter of this whole thing was kind of all about a dream you had when you were really young, so before you could even Streber or Hollywood any memories.
Wait, no, that dream wasn't when I was young. It might have sounded, because in the dream I was young.
I see.
But I had it when I was 30.
Okay,
let me think. It was 90. It was about 94, so I would have been mid-20s.
Yeah, I see what you mean, and you can't chalk it up all to because you were going through the Streber books and the movies, because if I read Castaneda a little bit, I'll have weird ass dreams of Don Juan. I don't think he's really there, but it's more than that with the Streber kind of ish dreams, I guess is what you're saying.
Well, it's probably not more than the Castaneda dreams I had, because I dreamt of Don Juan for years and I was sure that that it was really him. I'm like, I've made contact.
So do you relate these two dream types at all, like in your mind? Like, can you see any similarities or
between the Castaneda?
Not the terror feelings, but the format of any of the dreams, like beings that are not physical necessarily, but that are there. Like, I'm just curious if the Streber-ish dreams have any connotation with the Castaneda type dreams, and maybe this can happen no matter what you're reading.
They did, because they were what were often called big dreams, although I'm not sure if big dreams tend to be really symbolic, so there's different levels. I've had dreams of where I felt I was encountering gods and in these other realms and stuff, but I guess maybe this is slightly in between normal dreams and the really big cosmic dreams, but in any event, dreams in which I felt that I was actually interacting with real consciousness, and consciousness that was far higher than ordinary human consciousness. So whether it was visitors, as I called them back then after Whitley, or whether it was Nahals and sorcerers after Castaneda, they were similar in the sense that this is what I thought of as the second attention in Castaneda's phrase. This was another life that I was living, congruent or simultaneous with this one, but that I could only remember through dreams.
And viewing it all through the Castaneda lens, sort of.
Largely, yeah. So then I would still say that this is true for me, that when I sleep, I enter into states of consciousness where I have interactions with other consciousnesses, and they are as real as this conversation we're having now. I would still say that is my belief, right?
Yeah. I think that's true. Not to poo-poo psychic phenomena with this whole MK Ultra triggering psychic powers, blah, 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 because something about this, I don't know if it's a power or whatever we have as we become more embodied, like, ironically, I guess, the more you're embodied, the more, I don't know if I can even, if that's true, but like, you know what I mean? The more at peace you are, maybe the more you can open up to big dreams or, I don't know, more of a clear functioning.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think how big they are is perhaps, of course, that's relative. So certainly, the more we can, I imagine, the more. Well, actually, I'm on the fence about this because, it seems to me that I actually remember my dreams less, and I have less big dreams the more present I am in my waking life. And part of it is almost deliberate and definitely conscious, is, well, why do I want to remember this? Not that I'm not having the experiences, but why do I want to bring them back into this
this place where
this state of consciousness, so I can, because I used to write down all my dreams. The first book I wrote was woven together from dreams. So this idea that we can, that I could use the experiences of those other realms or that other state of consciousness to somehow big up this life, that's so fundamental to what the constructed identity does in relation to spirituality. And I would say that that's what MKUltra is in essence. In fact, recently I was thinking that the perfect metaphor for MKUltra and for the second matrix and, you know, bogus spirituality is this desire I always had as a kid, which was, one, just once, I want to be able to bring something from a dream into waking up and for it to be there in my hand, because I kept having these dreams of this amazing gift or this amazing whatever it was, and then I would wake up and, oh, it's gone. And I would even have dreams where I'm gonna bring it this time, you know, and it was like I'd almost found the way to actually bring it through from the dream realm into this realm, and of course it never worked.
Yeah, that dream, I think, gets around, too. I can't tell you how many friends, like, they were showing me this beautiful invention in my dream, and I couldn't bring it out. And I've even seen that in cartoons, like The Simpsons, you know? Homer is having a dream. He needs some money, you know, and he can't bring it out of the dream.
Right. So that's a great, more than a metaphor, isn't it? But it's just a sort of quintessential microcosmic example of that, the way that the constructed identity wants to repossess or co-opt, whatever the correct verb would be, the riches, the treasures of the psyche, to bring them over into its own petty domain.
And like, furnish. Give me that. The psyche can't have that. I want that here and now.
But it is the psyche. That's the thing. The treasure is the psyche.
I see.
So, and you can't. It's a bit like the old camel through the eye of the needle thing. You can't, just as you can't bring something over from a dream into this world, you can't make the psyche fit the riches and the depths of our souls. You can't make them fit into the framework of the constructed identity. You can certainly try, and MKUltra, it seems the way that MKUltra figured to do that is you break the psyche into lots of little pieces so you can squeeze the pieces, you know, in, because if they're just in pieces, they'll fit.
Yeah, totally. And like I sent you a note that, too, this whole trauma mutation, this is all hot in all these X-Men movies now, and the government injects a regular human with the purple stuff, and then they traumatize the shit out of him, and he's a superhero.
Right. And then the X-Men movies are being made by Bryan Singer.
Oh, Singer. I know his name from a few places.
Yeah, well, Bryan Singer, yeah, he's been doing them from the start, and he's, well, okay, so he began with Usual Suspects, or, well, before that, it was Public Access, it was a very small movie, then Usual Suspects was his breakout movie, and then after that, I believe it was the third one he did, At Pupil, which was a Stephen King novel about a Nazi, relating to a young boy, like a teenage or pre-adolescent boy. Stephen King. Yeah. So anyway, that just seemed like a bit of interesting data there. But the reason I brought up Bryan Singer is that he's the most notorious alleged sexual abuser in Hollywood, really, and not as in he's the worst, but he's the most high-profile person who's been.
Yeah, like he
named.
Was probably in Corey Haim's book or whatever there, but his name gets around a lot.
I don't know if he was in either of the Corey books, but of the two books, I don't know. I know there were two Coreys, but he, it's been for years now, because it was actually the boy from App Pupil, I think. It happened on App Pupil, but it's been happening since, allegedly. But he was the particular victim of abuse who came forward, and so it went to trial, and it got mostly buried.
Yeah, if it's Hollywood and little boys, it's going to get buried.
Yeah, yeah, the open secret.
Yeah, exactly.
That has not been distributed. But anyway, just to, just does seem more than a trivial correspondence there, that the guy, that the filmmaker most responsible for bringing the mutation X-Men superpower through trauma meme via Hollywood is himself
doing it in real life to people.
Yeah.
Well, that, I mean, I hate to say it, but it totally makes sense.
Well, like it does if he was engineered. I mean, it's highly speculative, but after the Leonard Cohen exploration with Dan Diamond, I really had to take quite seriously this idea, and Whitley, of course, that cultural figures are being created through trauma from a very young age. I mean, and we put it in bald terms, it does sound like science fiction, but as you know, I don't, you know, I put a lot of evidence on the table and try not to just make wild statements at the end of it, but it's a bit different on a podcast. You've got to try and be succinct, and and at some level, yeah, this does appear quite compelling evidence for this.
Yeah, and this is, maybe that's what makes these cultural figures that are so popular, Angelina Jolie, Lady Gaga, etc., they've all been traumatized and put up in front of us, and we resonate with them, not only because they blast us with them on TV, but because we all have this wound, maybe a little bit. I don't know how it works for the ladies, but like that helps it resonate and perpetuate even more.
There is the correspondent or sympathy of trauma, for sure, yes. And there's something I wanted to talk to George Hansen about, actually, which is, if you know him, the paranormal and the trickster, because it relates to liminality, and that is how trauma can create charisma. And charisma is a kind of psychic power, if you think about it. It's just a very subtle kind, but if you can spellbind people with your personality, that's a power, right?
I'm a waiter. I'm a firm believer in what you just said.
So, but have you considered how trauma might actually create charismatic personalities?
Yeah, to disassociate super far from it, you always have this sort of outgoing, swaggering...
Whatever it is. I mean, charisma doesn't have to be a swagger.
True, exactly. But whatever aspect it takes.
Yeah, the fragment that basically takes control of the whole thing and has that power, you know, kind of siphons off the energy of the psyche to use for its own ends. Yes, it would have abundant resources of seduction and charisma and all the rest of it. And as you say, part of it would be the message embedded in this is that for those of us who've been not necessarily less traumatized, but we haven't been able to turn our trauma into currency, that sends a message of you too can be a super charismatic cultural leader. embrace your trauma. Right?
Yeah.
It's kind of Pied Piper-like as well.
Yeah, how about that? I never even thought of it that way. But yeah, I mean, I think that's a huge key to this whole thing is what they give us through Hollywood and the music industry and, you know, this Western world here and all these kids growing up with these trauma heroes. And you have the mess we're in. Or the interesting situation, I don't want to say mess. Getting late over here in New Hampshire, so not a mess.
So have you read Seen and Not Seen or any of it?
Well, I may have mentioned, I don't know if you remember, I downloaded it in Russia, when my friends were all at work. I created a little English-speaking bubble in the apartment I was staying at, so I'd pull up a blog or a podcast. So I've made it through maybe 90 pages.
Okay. Because
scratch the surface, basically.
Well, that's a third of the way through, so that's more than scratching the surface. But I ask because you were saying that you weren't sure, you know, how much we had been traumatized and engineered and whatnot, and that's partly an exploration of that, of the way in which a culture that is itself created through as part of a kind of collective dissociation mechanism, because this brings it to Becker and the denial of death and all that, how culture itself is in a way a response to the traumatic awareness of death, even just at the most fundamental level. But anyway, the more the culture is shaped by that reaction to trauma and traumatic awareness, the more that culture then is traumatizing in a weird way, because it's I mean, that sounds paradoxical, because the culture is created as a kind of lullaby, but of course when you think about the lullabies, I mean, they're full of violence and brutality and horror stories.
Yeah, the cradle will fall out of the tree.
Is that an expression?
Oh, no, it's like, it's a lullaby. We have a rockabye baby.
Oh, yeah.
When the bow breaks, the cradle will rock.
Right. No,
yeah. That's pretty traumatizing lullaby right there.
Yeah. I mean, not to say that that lullaby itself would be traumatic necessarily, but it reflects.
Yeah, baby falling out of a tree.
It reflects the, I mean, it's like the fairy tales that, because I'm certainly not prescribing, the cultural artifacts should be more anemic, and they should, because that's happening too, right? Everything is getting, it's sort of both things happening at the same time, that all this violent imagery and the rest of it on the one hand, and then kids have to wear helmets just to go to the toilet and all the rest of it, the overprotective thing. So I'm not, the fairy tales need to be horrific and violent, and I don't think a fairy tale itself is traumatizing, but that why do kids need fairy tales to be really dark and grisly? Well, because the reality that they're born into, the cultural reality itself, is so dark, and that's not being acknowledged.
Yeah, totally, and it's a little hint, because they're young, fairy tales are for the kids, so it's just like, hey guys, welcome to Earth, here's a little song for you, it'll make sense later.
Mm-hmm. Well, Crowley did a thing, not to cite that guy, but anyway, it just popped into my head, about how you could analyze limericks and fairy tales for their Kabbalistic meaning, and he showed an example of it, and I can't remember which it was, but it had all this encoded meaning, which is what they're doing. But they've done a lot with Disney, and so it's a very blurry overlap, because I can certainly believe that Disney, that there could be technicians at Disney who are briefed and told to put certain subliminal stuff in, for sure. Why not? We know it happened with advertising. Yeah. But then on the other hand, there's also just the more organic thing, in the way that the unconscious just bleeds through into all this stuff anyway. So it's both, right? You could analyze a fairy tale and say, my God, look, it's got this and that and the other, Wizard of Oz. But that doesn't mean it was put there consciously. Some of it might have been, but a lot of it is just there because we're constantly trying to work out this trauma and trying to talk about it in a way that's safe.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't want to get into Kubrick necessarily at all or yet, but it makes me think, like, The Shining, how much is Kubrick and crew's precision, and how much is just the unconscious of everybody together?
Did you say Kubrick and crew's?
No, just Kubrick and, like, in The Shining, they say, because it's The Shining is a technical masterwork full of clues, I said.
Oh, clues.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, completely. I mean, that's one of the things of interest about Kubrick to me, because if you plant enough of those, then people will find countless more that weren't planted there, because you create the context, and then
exactly.
the brain starts seeking it.
You threw the bacon on the stove and they can smell it.
Right.
Yeah, it's funny. I guess I have a sort of random question. I don't want to derail it. I guess it goes back to MK Ultra. What's up with all these guys in the 80s there, like with getting the Catcher in the Rye, Hinckley and Sirhan and...
I guess that's an example of one of these supposed cultural artifacts that is, part of a programming agenda, like Wizard of Oz.
It's another piece of bacon on the stove. I see.
No, I wasn't. That wasn't my answer, really. I was just thinking out loud. I mean, it is an example of a cultural artifact that has now been attributed with kind of all kinds of occult.
I mean, it's endless. It's Freemasonry or MK Ultra or Atwell. Joseph Atwell is the guy. Mostly, I think, now.
So do you follow Jan Irving's work, then?
John Irving.
John Irving, you know, Gnostic Media.
Oh, Jan Irving.
Jan
Irving. Jan. Yeah. I mean, I know the name, but I can't say that I follow him.
Because Joe Atwell and he do a thing together. It seems like every week.
I have fond, because I'm from New Hampshire, and Salinger sort of, he was a recluse when he was older, and he lived, like, down the street from me, basically. Like, I'd say 30 minutes away, so everyone in my area, it's like, oh, Salinger lives down the road, he wrote Catcher in the Rye, so everyone reads it when they're young, despite the bad language.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, to see it everywhere, just, I was like, oh, I remember that book from when I was a kid, and...
Mm-hmm. Did you see the documentary about him recently?
Yes, the one that they said they had to re-edit or something. There was some trouble because they were saying he was kind of a pedophile or something.
It seemed like there was some hints around that, if I remember rightly. Yeah, and then is it the year of Salinger, isn't it? This year isn't when they're going to be releasing all these unpublished works.
Oh yeah, I think that is this year, or 2007. It's this year or next year, yeah.
Hmm.
But yeah, like you say, he gets around. Kubrick gives a nod to Salinger all the time too. Like in various movies, I kind of draw a loose correlation. I'll see a scene in Shining, and it'll make me think of a part in this book. Like anyway, Holden is like, if they had the bomb, I would sit on that thing and ride all the way down. You know, I'd volunteer to ride the bomb down to the Earth, and you know, and that's in Strange Love, and like it gets around.
Right. So, what do you think about that?
Oh, I mean, like I say, I try to keep it liminal, Jason. I don't know what to think about that shit.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it's interesting. I think, I mean, I don't tell my friends this always in no polite company, but Kubrick is deeper into this, like, creating the false meaning for the world than I think people even realize yet. And I can't say how or why, but... it probably goes back to the whole Apollo 11 through 17, and like Kubrick used his skills there to sort of use the distorted perception of everyone, distort it with the film camera to install a fake, you know, you have a quote something like this, a fake message of importance to the inner growth of the individual. And I think Kubrick is more, you know, important to that than a lot of people maybe.
Right. Well,
I think I took that quote out of context. I think that was from Whitley's wife, who has a few interesting quotes in your article.
Whitley's wife?
I think so. Don't you quote her a few times, or a lady who's involved with Whitley?
I think I quote Anne Streber a couple of times, but certainly not frequently.
Well, there's like two that stuck in my head because they seem to be like so revealing of Whitney's problem that it's amazing they both don't see it.
Oh, right. Well, so yeah, there was an Anne Streber quote that was like that about how the.
The aliens were using Whitley's
own neuroses, basically, to teach him lessons.
So I'm saying Kubrick was using the neuroses that he understood all too well to teach a lesson, good and or bad.
Right.
What it is, I don't know. But, But if it ties in with sort of, they have these, you know, figures giving a fake wounded culture what they need and want and a little bit extra, just, you know, Kubrick, I don't put him out of the people that would have been involved.
Experience with operative, undercover operatives or intelligence agencies or anything like that? This just sounds like a this is what you ask. You've got to ask a policeman. Are you now? Have you ever been a policeman? I didn't mean it in that way, but like,
No, honestly, I mean, I'm just a normal guy that has a weird book collection, if you ask me, and like the simple answer.
Well, okay.
But like, I've never had any contact with any government officials, or never been arrested, or any of that.
You've never
jazz.
Had contact with government officials.
Well, okay. Beyond the registering my car and etc.
Uh huh. So, but yeah, even not allowing for undercover operatives, that seemed like quite a preposterous statement, because yeah, the government officials, there's no way not to have dealings with them. But certainly when it comes to undercover, because how would you know?
Well, exactly. Like, if I was... Are you saying that have I been...
I was just wondering if you've ever thought...
Oh, no, no. I don't do anything sketchy enough to warrant government surveillance.
Well, there's government surveilling all of us now.
Okay, then, like, boots on the ground government surveillance.
Right, okay. But that doesn't mean you wouldn't have interacted with operatives.
Maybe, I suppose.
I mean, they might not have... They wouldn't have to be deployed to you to interact with you, if you see what I mean. Because they're just regular people, right? They've got to go about doing stuff...
Mm-hmm.
As operatives, I mean, besides what their job is telling them to do, they're also just going around. So, for example, you could be married to an operative. It wouldn't be because... Are you married, by the way?
No.
Okay, well, it's a good thing then. You could have a girlfriend who is an operative, and it wouldn't mean that she was assigned your case. She was just an operative, and she had a boyfriend, but she wouldn't be able to tell you because she was an operative.
Well, I mean, maybe a couple strange foreign girls that I've, you know, traveled with, they said they worked at an office. No, but I don't think so. No, not in this country anyway. I met some interesting folks in Russia, but I don't think any were KGB.
Well, you know, in... where was it I was talking about recently? I think it was in... I'm going to get it wrong. I think it might have been Eastern Germany... Anyway, somewhere in Europe, like around World War II, after World War II, the percentage of operatives, ordinary people, was like 50%.
Wow.
We don't know what the percentage is now. I think we do know that it's going up, it's on the rise. And if you factor into that you've got paid informants, and then a sort of spectrum where they're not necessarily paid informants in the usual sense, as in snitches, but people who run bars, for example, and the government approaches them and says, you want to make a bit of extra money, you just need to write a report for us every week, or
like who
is.
Comes in, what they talk about, who they come in with.
Exactly.
Oh.
Right? So this is not something that we would know or could research, like, to how thorough are these agencies, but we can, you know, we can deduce from other things that they seem to be very thorough, that there's more and more funding and more personnel, you know, officially involved with intelligence work, and that the world is becoming more and more sort of in a paranoid state of perennial warfare, where intel and espionage surveillance is more and more justified. So, although I doubt that it's 50% of people that are operatives in one shape or form or another, it could be as high as, what, one in four people, or let's just say, just to be, just to have some fun with it. And then that means what? Like, if we know 30 people or 50 people or 100 people, that means that the equivalent number are going to be operatives.
Yeah, like,
and yet, if you go through a list of everyone you know, how many are you going to put a star by and say, well, that one's that one could be an operative?
Exactly. Like, they
none
would have
them, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I see what you mean, but I'm trying to think now, like, I would hope that I could fly under the radar, you know, unless this...
What radar, though?
Well, like, I'm not doing anything necessarily dangerous to the slave...
But this isn't about that. I mean,
this
that would be relevant to me.
I
could start, we're just talking about general surveillance and people
who
aren't spying on you, but are spying on somebody.
They're just spying.
They're just spying.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm sure they're out there. Do I think about it and or worry about it? Hell no.
Well, the reason I brought it up wasn't so you'd worry about it, because we were talking about Kubrick and Sanger, and this idea, okay, who's an insider, and do the insiders like to signal to each other? because that's how operatives work. Yeah. They've got to be able to, well, they don't have to be able to know each other, because a lot of time they won't, but some of the time they need to be able to recognize each other, and they might want to be recognized by another, or like Masonic handshakes, they might want to find out who's an operative, so they would have code words and whatnot to signal, like Kubrick and Salinger, are you one of them? I thought you were, right?
Yeah.
So you could do it in the whole, the culture itself could be partly used as this signaling system for identifying who's who. Like, of course, in espionage, they use culture to, you know, for coded to get coded information to their allies, right?
Yeah,
in a way that the enemy wouldn't recognize it. That
synchromysticism.
I did a tweet recently, which was that synchromysticism has made operatives work infinitely easier. And you got it, and people retweeted it, and I thought I'm really surprised people got that, because it seemed to me that it would need unpacking. So why you laughed? So you must have got something. So what did that mean to
well,
you?
Well, it's actually super funny and relevant. Like I said, I came like 2009-10. I didn't even use the internet basically before then. So I got to these synchromystic kids, and they were all kind of my age, into the same kind of music and trippy video editing, and I was like, these kids seem cool, I'll hang out here, watch a few videos, you know. So I'm there for a couple weeks, and then there's this crazy, a schism in the synchromystic community, and half of the kids were using this stencil, or whatever you want to call synchromysticism, to point out, like you're saying, the bullshit in the narrative, right? And the other half were using it to push a like New Age, Love and Light, Star Child thing, so they kicked this one kid off the blog. He started another blog with some friends called Haters, as opposed to G8ORS, the Gators. Mm-hmm. And they made a bunch of videos, like, I don't know if I agree with everything, but like exposing the gay agenda or this or that thing. That's a little more controversial, not necessarily the love and light that Jake Kotze and some of the other kids were into. So I kind of sided with the Stinkro guys. I helped them blog a little bit.
Do they call themselves Stinkro Mysticism?
That was the joke, because they latched on to the anal obsession of these cultural motherfuckers, or whatever these guys are. So, whole anal fixation in Hollywood music. And I think that's what originally started it, is that someone was doing the spade sync, I guess. So spade is a euphemism for butthole, and it started the war there. So I thought all the Stinkro mystics, which they, I think, mockingly called themselves, I sided with those guys because they kind of took a step back and laughed at the whole thing, whereas opposed to the other guys seemed to be creating like a dogma, I guess. So I just got that tweet when you said it. It's just...
saw the tweet?
No, when you said it just then.
Oh, when I said it. when you say got it, though, but what did it mean to you? Because
what these kids were calling synchromysticism, it's all it is really is, like you're saying, this signaling / coding the culture for bullshit kind of thing. And the other kids seemed to see it like as a weapon, being used as a weapon, and the fact that they were pointing it out was hilarious to me, I guess.
Okay. So, but that seems quite vague. So do you mean that it's a way to spread memes and stuff like that?
Maybe. Yeah. I don't know if memes is the right word, but again, to transmit messages of importance, you know, that are important to the controllers, not to the individual.
Right. So, okay, so how I meant it, and I don't put, maybe no one else got it on Twitter either, they just liked it because whatever.
Because it said synchromysticism and controllers.
just in this very vague way that you responded to it. What I meant was that Keith Sabatsky had just told me that, I think it was Douglas Bowles, I don't know how to pronounce his name, and Jason Barrera, you know, those two, they were corresponding for a long time, for years, I think, before they found out they lived on the same street. And of course they were sync heads, so it's like, whoa, dude, sync,
whatever.
Yeah. So, and that was when I said, oh well, synchromysticism makes it much easier for intelligence agencies to do their work, because you just go, hey dude, it's a sync. Like the operatives can do all kinds of weird shit now that's totally improbable, and in the past you'd have gone, wait a minute, something's not right about that. Now you just say, oh my god, the sinks are piling up.
Oh yeah. It's also funny that way though, Jason.
Yeah.
Yeah, how about that? Yeah, it's like it's a shorthand for like, I get that. That's pretty funny.
Well, yeah, I mean,
but I have to like agree with, you know, both my previous interpretation of it and yours as well.
Well, the latter is, I mean, it was new to me. I mean, I hadn't thought of it until I thought of it. Just like, well, operatives do, they depend on, and I made a joke in Occult Yorkshire, I think, you know, did the CIA invent the phrase truth is stranger than fiction?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
As long as we believe that these wildly improbable things happen, and that's just the nature of reality, they can get away with all kinds of wildly improbable stuff, and we won't smell a rat. So
yeah, yeah. Because we've all heard that phrase before, so it's assumed to be true. Yeah, yeah. And that probably, you can extrapolate that to everything, and before you know it, like, you're in a box.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily, of course, we don't want to be in boxes. And so, I mean, if anything, like the question of what's an operative and who's an operative and who isn't is very far-reaching, right? Because I think of operatives as relatively, well, I don't know how recent, because Machiavelli, it goes back pretty far, actually. But certainly don't tend to think of intelligence operatives in the time of Jesus, really. Most of us probably. But there certainly
Agent,
would have been.
Agent Judas.
Yeah, for example. Why wouldn't there have been? Yeah. And so how far back does it go? And then how much is, as Jan Irving believes, how much is occultism really just a form of, I mean, just a vehicle for these intelligence operatives to do their thing? You know, how much are they synonymous, really?
Well, yeah, you had Crowley and MI5. There was a whole chapter, a little mention of that in this whole thing, either now or in the Occult Yorkshire, like the Crowley, yeah, MI5, sure, spy in East Germany connection.
Sure, yeah. So, and there are cases where one can actually trace the connections and say, okay, he's an occultist, he was also an operative. So those are obviously quite conclusive and very suggestive. But again, if we go deep enough into it, you see that it's really one kind of beast or one animal.
Yeah, and I think that's the trippiest part about the whole writing you're doing now, is that at any point you can zoom in as far as you want or as far back as you want, like, and it all sort of still seems like one big beast, as you said.
Right, and then we're on the inside, we're not on the outside, right?
Yeah, yeah, you can only zoom out so far, right? You're still in it.
You're in it, yeah.
Monkey said the man, I want your fireman. Said the monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said the man.
Right, then, that's the end of my conversation with Mike B. Next week I'll be talking once again with Lewis Proud. And after that with Mari. Another Mari. And after that with Zanor, a very interesting blogger. After that, I'm not sure. I'm making a last minute outro. I wasn't going to bother, but because of an interesting development, perhaps that's an understatement, it is to me, to some of you maybe, also, that Whitley Strieber has, for the first time ever really, publicly acknowledged me, I suppose, and what I've been writing about him and his claims and whatnot. He's done so in a fairly marginal venue, that is at the Texas Monthly, where there was a review of The Supernatural, February 2016. Actually, as far as I know, the only reviews of The Supernatural, besides my own, that have appeared so far have been at Texas-based website periodicals. Anyway, I made some comments there a month ago or so about Strieber and MKUltra, and he has responded to that and denied some of the things that I've said, and I've responded to him, but my response hasn't gone through. I don't know if it will or not. Anyway, I think this will interest some of you, so I'll include a link in the show notes to that. Thanks to Svatoslav for a monthly donation. and thanks to you all for continuing to participate in this very strange, very liminal, for me very transformative project that this is. I am finding it harder and harder to find new non-copyright marginal music free music archives, so if anyone wants to volunteer to go through some of the bands there or just make suggestions about bands who give their music away for free who'd like to hear on the Liminalist, I would be happy to get some pointers. Bye for now.
The monkey spoke when his lip came tumbling man, my desire is to be